podcast this week. Somebody send help, is the cry of Rachel McAdams and Dylan O'Brien as they talk to some deranged Sam Raimi-loving lunatic about their new movie, Send Help. All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is gutted at blowing the audition for SNL UK. How hard is it to say, live from London, it's Saturday night? Turns out, very. Anyway, hello pod, I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Emperor Podcast. This week I'm joined in the pod with my three colleagues of such lethal cunning, all of whom have wonderful nicknames. There is, of course, Geek Queen Helen O'Hara. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. SNL UK shot near me recently.
Did it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's like a title sequence or if they're doing a few pre-planned bits, but they were on Deptford High Street.
That's exciting news. Yeah. Ooh, wow.
So the story goes, anyway.
Blimey. All right. Helen has her finger on the pulse, as you would expect of a geek queen. Who else are we joined by? We're joined by Amon, make love not, Warman.
Hello. I'm good.
I have never bespoke that nickname on you at any point.
I was wondering what you're going to go with. Yeah. My official nickname is Amonimus. That's kind of the moniker I've been going.
I bestow the nicknames around here, my friend.
You don't get to choose your own. I've learned this to my peril.
No, that's not how this works. But Amonimus is good, yeah. But has anyone ever made a play on the Make Love, Not War?
Well,
no?
You're the first.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good advice. Good advice. Anyway, we're also joined by the former Camino Kid,
that was
the artist,
never my name.
Formerly known as the Camino Kid. Everyone talked about it. It's all they could talk about. James Dyer. Now, as you may know, James, of course, finally rejected that nickname.
Yes.
And we have set out on a quest to find him a new one with the help of you guys, the listeners. Last week's suggestion, the Wank Worshipper, was also finally rejected.
Yeah.
Okay, so Jimbo, this week's suggestion comes from John Worrell on Blue Sky, and it is, this isn't going to stick, 53.
What?
Yeah. As in, apparently, according to John Worrell, in a recent pilot, already ixnay because it means he listens to pilot, James declared anything that gets 53% on Metacritic as pretty dire.
Oh, I see.
Oh.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. What do you think?
I mean,
53
going to stick?
Pretty.
That's true.
You are pretty.
You can call me pretty dire.
You're aging like a fine wine and getting prettier with every passing week, I would say.
I like to think so. I think it's a little bit too oblique. I think it requires too much insider knowledge.
Yes. Okay. I don't know. James 53 dire. I don't know. I don't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is the nickname that was bestowed upon you, Mr. Hewitt?
I'm just cool with being Fabuloso.
Yes, that is
Fabuloso,
indeed what
or,
we call you behind
or
your back.
Or Mr. Cool,
mm-hmm,
or Giant Spuds, you know, just whatever comes into your
the
mind.
The human tripod, yeah. All of that stuff.
All of these things.
Yeah.
Snake.
The snake. Mr. Loverman.
Flame
you know.
Boy.
I'm happy with any of these, really. But it's James we're trying to find a nickname for. But 53 has not cut the mustard.
No.
If you have any more nicknames for James, do send them in. Find me on social media, whether it be Blue Sky or Instagram or Threads or Twitter, and let me know what you think James should be called, and we'll find it. We'll find the right nickname for this man, even if it kills us. All right, shall we have a question?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right, so the question comes from, God, who did send it in? Oh, God. They call me Chris the Prepared. There's a nickname. Spreadsheet Hewitt. Let me see. Here it is. The question. The question this week comes from Michael Curley on Blue Sky. Hey, Chris. Just curious, who would be in your Mount Rushmore of EGOTs? The question just came to me. Yes. Completely organically. Shut up. Anyway. So, should we explain what this is before we get into it? Helen, mm-hmm. What is an EGOT?
An EGOT is an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. It is the ultimate accolade of the American arts, I guess.
Yeah.
Or at least entertainment arts. You know, the Pulitzer, for example, doesn't count. So, I'm just
it
saying.
Doesn't count?
Well, it's not an EGOT award, is it?
It's just very like hard. You know, Denzel Washington would be unlikely to win a Pulitzer.
I mean, maybe he should just try harder.
That's your advice
for Denzel Washington. Yeah. I mean, look, there's a Pulitzer Prize for drama, right? So, like, he could just, you know, write a play.
What about the Nobel Prize?
That's for literature, which includes drama.
Okay.
I believe.
Well, I'm just saying, if you added that as well, then it could be a Negot or a Pegot.
Pegont.
Yeah.
That sounds wrong.
And what happens then if someone else were to win that prize, but then you got that person to give you their prize? Does that qualify?
That wouldn't count, no, because they still won the prize. You're just some dude who now has custody of a shiny thing.
Well, say, for example, I'm just saying here, but say sure. Timmy Two Meats wins the Best Actor Oscar this year for Marty Supreme.
Sure.
And then someone, I'm not going to name any names, obviously, right. But says, hey, that's a nice Best Actor Oscar, give it to me.
Be ashamed if anything happened to it. Yeah.
Then would that person trump, for example, Chalamet's victory and take it for himself?
No, because he didn't appear in Marty Supreme. Like, he still
didn't
hasn't
he?
Done the work.
Okay, all right, okay. Anyway, so that's what an EGOT is. EGOT is someone who has won all four of those, and the reason we're talking about it this week is because, let me see, James, why are we talking about it this week?
It's hard to say.
I know.
Someone may or may not have been added to the ranks of EGOT winners. Someone relatively low profile, who most people probably haven't heard of, but, you know.
Yes.
We should mention him here.
And that was Steven Anonymous Spielberg.
That's the one.
Of course. This week won, what was it, a Grammy?
A Grammy.
He won a Grammy.
What for?
For producing or being one of the producers on the John Williams documentary that came out last year. It means it has taken him 35 years, because I've got the list up here on Wikipedia. It's taken him 35 years to complete his EGOT, which is frankly lazy. So I'm going to very, very quickly read out the 22 or 23 people, and then we can Mount Rushmore them. We each get a choice because there's four of us.
I have a question.
Okay, please.
Are we talking only competitive EGOT winners or non-competitive?
Yes.
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 Which is, you know, it's upsetting to me personally as a Barbra Streisand fan.
But well, it's just like upsetting to me as a James L. Jones fan.
Also,
so.
Yeah.
It's upsetting to me as a Liza Minnelli fan.
Of course it is.
But let's move on, shall we? So the competitive EGOT winners, the ones who actually worked for their trophies, are Richard Rodgers, Helen Hayes, Rita Moreno, John Gielgud, darling, Audrey Hepburn, Marvin Hamlisch, Jonathan Tunick, no, I don't know who that is either, Mel Brooks, Mike Nichols, Whoopi Goldberg, Jesus Christ, Scott Rudin, Robert Lopez, Andrew Lloyd Webber, dear darling, Tim Rice, Jesus Christ, they just throw these things out like confetti, don't they? John Legend, Alan Menken, for his sterling work on Captain America, the First Avenger. Yes. Jennifer Hudson, Viola Davis, Elton John, Benji Pasek, Justin Paul, and Steven Spielberg. Mm. So Pasek and Paul, who are, you know, songwriters to the stars, they completed it in the shortest amount of time, 7 years from their first award to completing the EGOT. And the longest gap was 45 years for Helen Hayes. And we all know what she won those awards for. So I don't think we need to dwell on it.
Did you hear that Quincy Jones' name in that?
No, because he didn't win non-competitive
EGOT award.
It's like,
yes.
You weren't listening, Amon. No, you weren't listening. Honestly. But there we go. So, all right. Helen.
Yes.
I'll go around the table in a clockwise fashion. You're sitting immediately to my left. Who's your choice for your Mount Rushmore of EGOTs?
Do you know what? Right. You know, my instinct in all things is to say Steven Spielberg first and foremost. Like, they're like,
you want to take him off the board?
But
you're not going to.
But I'm as usual giving myself some criteria here, right? And I am kind of trying to find the people.
You always do this.
I know. Yeah. Okay. And I'm trying to find the people where I unreservedly love the things or admire the things where they won all four awards for, you know?
Okay.
To be fair, though, he needs to have at least one or two stripped out for West Side Story, so.
Get the fuck out of here.
I think that disqualifies him.
He absolutely, anyway. And I also feel like, you know, with respect, like, some people, like, they clearly excel in a couple of these fields, and then they've just, you know, produced something to win a prize. So
right.
I want the people who genuinely excel in all four fields. That's what I'm looking for here. And
like a big old farmer.
The one that is actually standing out to me, I'm going to go for, because I'm not sure who else will, is I'm going to go for Mike Nichols.
Mike Nichols.
Yep.
All right. So Mike Nichols, he won his Academy Award for directing The Graduate. Yeah, I mean, it's all right. He won several Emmys.
I'm going for Angels in America.
Angels in America. He won a Grammy for Best Comedy Performance in 1962, An Evening with Mike Nichols and Elaine May.
Yeah, and that's like a generational defining comedy album. Like, that's like Eddie Murphy Raw. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like that's... It's not
you
just,
picked Raw
not,
over Delirious?
It's not a lot like being
Raw. No, but in terms of defining the generation it is, and I feel like it's not like he's just done an audiobook.
True,
again, with respect to the people who did an audiobook.
And he won many, many Tonys for
And he won many, many Tonys, again, including loads of, like, classic
Monty Python
productions. Yeah, but also like Barefoot in the Park and The Odd Couple.
All right, so you're putting Mike Nichols on the Mount Rushmore of EGOTs.
Yeah.
The Northern Irish version, of course, is EJOT. Thank you.
Hey.
Amon.
Hello.
You can't say Quincy Jones.
That has been understood. See, this is a tricky one for me because I clearly need to watch more plays.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't,
I mean, these are Broadway
forget about
shows.
The plays. We won't have seen these. It's fine.
Yeah. So I'm just going off of
just pick somebody
impact
you like.
Impact on me.
Helen Hayes.
Impact on. Stop. So it's between probably John Legend and Alan Menken.
Oh. Alan Menken.
Don't influence
Look,
him. He's
I love John
his
Legend.
Own man.
I love John Legend, but it's Alan Menken out of those two. Come
yeah,
on.
I think you're right. I mean,
well, should we look at what they won for and then we can make that decision? Shall we do that?
Well, not least because I'm pretty sure Alan Menken's won it more than once. Okay, he's only got one Emmy, but otherwise.
So he's not a double EGOTer. He's just a solo EGOTer. He's an underachiever. So John Legend. do you know what John Legend's real name is, by the way?
John Legend.
His real name. John Rogers.
Yes, he wasn't born John Legend. To Mr. and Mrs. Legend, a son, John. His real name is John Stevens.
John Roger Stevens,
Roger,
specifically.
Roger. Yes. Roger! So I can see why he changed it. Do you think John Legend would have been as successful as he is, an amazingly talented man? Do you think he would have been as successful as he is had he kept John Stevens? Or do you think that he needed to become
John Roger
the
Stevens.
Legend? John Roger Legend to fulfill his potential.
Or would he be more successful if he'd been Roger Legend or
Roger
Stephen
Legend.
Rogers?
I think Roger Legend, that's John Holmes, isn't it?
Wow.
Sorry.
I think he's too talented of an artist for him not to be successful, is what I want to say.
Uh-huh. But
no, there is power in branding and name recognition, and I do think Legend helped that along a little bit.
Legend absolutely helped. You call yourself Legend. I mean, that's a bold name to bestow upon yourself, right?
I mean,
well,
look,
you have to live up to it.
I'm in search of a nickname. I think we might have stumbled across one. James Legend. I'm just putting it out there. I'm just putting it out there.
And there it will remain.
I think you mean James Roger Legend.
I'll take it.
Oh, man.
All right, we don't need to search for a nickname anymore. I'm just going to introduce Jimbo as the Roger Legend every single episode from now on. All right, John Legend, he won his Oscar for Glory from Selma, and not Best Supporting Actor for La La Land. He won a Primetime Emmy Award for Jesus Christ Superstar, Live in Concert.
Oh, boy.
I blew that audition.
Uh-huh.
Live from London. Just got
close.
So wrong. So wrong. He won three daytime Emmy Awards. He won lots of Emmys. He's won loads of Grammys. And he won one Tony Award for Jitney. Alan Menken, amazing composer, of course, songwriter. Many Academy Awards over the years. Emmy for Waiting in the Wings from Rapunzel's Tangled Adventure. They just give these things out like sweets. Grammy Awards, he's won many, many, many. And Tony Awards for Newsies. So, okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't have, looking at his you know, his Broadway career, I wouldn't have said Newsies was the one to put him over the top, personally, but there we go.
Wasn't Christian Slater in Newsies?
He was in the original film.
Yeah. This is the Broadway musical version. Okay, interesting. Yeah. All right, I'm on. Are you Legend or Menken?
I'm Menken.
Menken, he's gone Menken. All right, Menken's face.
The impact on the culture. I mean, those Oscars, Beauty and the Beast, incredible. And things that are going to, I mean, not to say that John Legend's work won't endure, but I just know that Beauty and the Beast is going to continue to be passed down generation to generation. That's powerful.
A tale as old as time, as
indeed.
It were.
Some might say.
And yet nothing for a Star-Spangled Man. From the
is
first Avenger.
An outrage.
It is an outrage. Mm-hmm. It's like when they overlooked Dobie for Best Original Song from Anchorman 2. Anyway, Alan Menken has the most Oscar wins by an Egypt. So that's very, very nice. He has won 8, which is amazing. All right, we're going clockwise, which means we come to James Roger Legend.
No, it doesn't sound right.
I'm trying it on for size. We'll see how it goes.
Roger for a size. Yeah, okay.
My legendary status. Oh, God. Who will I pick to go on my Mount Rushmore? It has to be Karen Elaine Gillen. Johnson.
Sorry.
Karen Elaine Johnson, a.k.a. Whoopi Goldberg. And who won, and this is absolutely true, she won her Academy Award, her Emmy, her Grammy, and her Tony for Jumper Jet Flash. And I think they were all soundly deserved, and I'm very much in her corner. So, yeah.
Yeah, Jumper Jet Flash, a work of such staggering genius that it transcended award ceremonies.
Right.
I believe it won the FA Cup that year as well,
also
didn't
true.
It?
Yeah.
And him, I thought that she won all of that for Sister Act.
Close, you would think
it was
so.
Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit, was the one that really put her over the edge. So you've gone for Whoopi Goldberg?
Yes.
And Whoopi Goldberg, I didn't know her real name was.
Yeah, Karen Elaine Johnson.
Karen Elaine Johnson, I did not know
would
that.
Would she have been as successful had she gone with Karen Elaine
Johnson? Karen
Johnson.
Karen Johnson in Burglar. Karen Johnson in Jumpin' Jack. No, it wouldn't have worked.
No, it doesn't.
Hey, do you want to see the new Karen Johnson TV show? No, it doesn't work. Karen Johnson is Guinan. Doesn't work. Whoopi Goldberg won the Best Actress in a Supporting Role for Ghost at the Academy Awards. She has won 2 Emmys for being the talk show host on The View.
Mm-hmm.
They give out stuff for being talk show host.
Yeah, of course.
We could win.
We couldn't win. We don't have a talk show. We have a podcast.
This is a talk show. It's like a talk show.
Actually, this is an interesting point because now that you've got Netflix doing video podcasts, in inverted commas, without necessarily union representation of the workers putting the show together, where does the limit exist between pod shows and talk shows? Pod shows and talk shows?
Pod shows? A pod show. Helen has invented a new genre. This is amazing. I think that the Golden Globes recently had the best podcast category, and it was fucking bullshit. Anyway.
Is that because we weren't nominated?
Well, not just that.
How is Good Hang with Amy Poehler better than the Empire Podcast?
I mean, it is just not. It is markedly.
I mean, you
it's just not. Like this is a great hang with Helen Amon and James Roger Legend. That's what this is.
True story.
And I haven't even put myself in the title, which I probably should have done. Anyway, Grammy Award, Whoopi Goldberg won Best Comedy Recording for Whoopi Goldberg Original Broadway Show Recording, catchy title, and she won her Tony for Thoroughly Modern Millie, Best Musical in 2002. So there we go.
All right.
Whoopi Goldberg. I guess I have to choose someone now, don't
you
I?
You do.
Oh, my Lord. It's tricky, right? Because...
No, tricky isn't one of them.
Hey, because obviously I want to go Elton John. No, obviously I want to go...
Mel Brooks?
I'm torn between Mel Brooks and Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
But I need to see what they won them for.
Okay.
So Mel Brooks won his Academy Award for Best Screenplay for The Producers. The Producers. He also won several Emmys for The Sid Caesar Show, for Mad About You, and three guest appearances on Mad About You, which I've never seen. He won 3 Grammys for The 2000-Year-Old Man and The Producers' Best Musical Soundtrack, and 3 Tonys also for The Producers, which is now back on the London stage. Mm. Live in London.
But, like, there's a lot of, you know, classic stuff there. Again, this is why I was quite tempted by Mel Brooks as well. Now, admittedly, that its producer is heavy, but it's still...
Producers.
Oh, boy. But it's still, like, the 2,000-year-old man is an enduringly great comic sketch. So that kind of thing, that sways me. Whereas, and you know
Swayze.
My beloved... No. And you know my beloved Spielberg. I mean, okay, we can't argue with, and we're not going to argue with Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan, are we?
That's what he won the Oscars for.
Yeah, we're not going to argue with A Pinky and the Brain Christmas because...
Like, I mean... Or you Band of Brothers. Should.
We absolutely should not. Pinky and the Brain is one of the great cartoons.
Oh,
I am not going to have
is it.
It. Yes.
Pinky he won a primetime
brain,
Emmy.
Brain.
It's no Jason the Wheeled Warriors.
Yes, it's much,
Who?
Much better.
Jason the Wheeled Warriors.
Good
Do you not remember this?
Is this Chortle and the Wheelies? Who's this?
Do you know it wasn't dissimilar?
Okay. Spielberg won an Emmy in 2003 for Outstanding Miniseries Taken.
Yeah, different Taken.
He doesn't know what you want.
He does. He has a particular set of skills.
He does.
Jesus, yeah.
But he also won for Band of Brothers in the Pacific, which is also hard to argue with. And more daytime Pinky and the Brain ones.
Yes. But that's cheating, isn't it?
Well,
that's cheating.
The one that's been controversial online this week has been Best Musical at the Tonys for A Strange Loop, because apparently there's some confusion over whether he was originally named as one of the producers on that
right.
at the time. So that's the one that's been slightly controversial. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about this. This is a tricky one. I am going to go... Oh, Steven Spielberg, one of the greatest film directors of all time.
The E-Goat.
Amon sealed it for me.
By saying E-Goat?
Yeah, I liked the wordplay.
I mean, that was fun.
It appealed to me.
Look, I'm not going to argue with it, because Pinky and the Brain, I mean everything else on that we just mentioned.
I, an E-Jot, I'm going to anoint the E-Goat and put Steven Spielberg up there so he sits alongside... Elaine Karen Johnson, or Karen Elaine Johnson, a.k.a. Whoopi Goldberg. He sits alongside Alan Menken, and he sits alongside Mike Nichols. There you go. That is an amazing, is a Mount Rushmore worthy of EGOT status in itself.
We've made some very controversial choices.
I mean, Helen Hayes is furious.
Helen
and the
Hayes,
second
like,
I find out who she is,
oh,
I'm going to go to bat for her.
I just, you know, I mean, John Gielgud, for God's sake.
Rita
Moreno.
Come on.
He's John Gielgud, not John Gielgrate.
It's true. He should
sure
have changed his name to Gielgoat, and then they could have put his name up there, right?
Oh, boy.
I mean, what did he win for? Arthur? Get the fuck.
Okay.
Come
on. A little respect here.
No respect. No respect for John Gielgud will be afforded to him on this podcast my demands are met.
Wow. That is outrageous.
All right.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Viola Davis, though?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, she is great. She is fantastic.
But in fairness, the Grammy is for an audiobook.
That's just cheating.
That feels less.
What was the book, though?
Finding Me is her memoir.
Oh, yeah, she's reading her own book.
Oh,
I mean, any agent can do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Women versus Hollywood. Audiobook read by yours truly out now.
Are there subtitles for your thick Northern Irish accent to help people?
Yes, it's called The Book. You have a copy. You can read it any time.
A well-thumbed copy.
So why? Believe me, I have thumbed that book intensively. But Hell's Bells. Okay. Yes, you got me. Well done. But here's my thing. If you're listening to the audiobook, why would you also have a copy of the actual book alongside you?
You read along like storyteller.
I'm not buying this fucking thing twice.
You didn't buy it once.
Once.
I've given you at least two copies.
Hoist by my own petard. Anyway, I'm sure we can all agree that we are all an EGOT. And let's move on, shall we? All right, so I am now incorporating a new format to the show.
Okay.
So we're only having one regular guest on each show as things stand going forward. Sometimes I might change. Sometimes we might have two guests. But for the most part, we'll have one guest per regular Mothership show. And then the other guests of this week will be collected into their own show that we're calling The Interviews. And that will be up separately. And this week it features Kristen Stewart. You know her.
Yay.
She's from those movies. And she directed The Chronology of Water this week. Also, we have Jared Bush, who is the director of Zootropolis 2. And we have Andrew Guest, literally a guest, talking spoilers for Wonder Man. So that will be out around the same time as this. So listen to that. But it means that we don't have a guest slot here. We're going to barrel straight into the movie news section. And we're going to start with some very, very sad news. Catherine O'Hara passed away last week. Amazing, amazing actress, of course. Hell's Bells.
Yeah. I can say as a representative of all the O'Haras that she was the best of us.
Was she ever at any family reunions?
You know, she didn't come to my family reunions, what with not being directly related to me.
I did notice she snubbed your wedding.
Yeah, she was there in spirit, though, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. I did try to get my dad to wear the Schitt's Creek wedding outfit that she wore to officiate that wedding, but he was sadly resistant. No, she was an incredible comic actress, broke through in SCTV, and kind of worked her way up alongside a lot of the other stars from that. You know, she worked with the likes of Eugene Levy, of course, and the likes of John Candy and stuff back in the day. And also, of course, with the Christopher Guest troupe, and she was a leading light of those movies. If you haven't seen, you know, A Mighty Wind, she is fantastic, fantastic in that. A lot of people's first encounter with her was probably like mine in Home Alone, where she was Kevin's mum, only mildly neglectful and incompetent. And I think a lot of people, if they didn't already have her seared into their brain, then Schitt's Creek did that job for them, because her Moira Rose in that show is one of the all-time great comic creations. The way she speaks is like literally nothing else on earth, and is completely unforgettable. And I just love
offbeat line readings. Yeah,
yeah, just weird pronunciations of very normal words. And yet she'll also just throw in sort of, you know, $5 words occasionally, just to show that it's not stupidity exactly with Moira Rose. It's just a weird kind of all-encompassing solipsism. I don't know what it is. It's amazing. It's an incredible, incredible character, an incredible performance. And it just felt like that was, you know, getting her due in a lot of ways. And she was getting a lot of love in the last few years as a result of that. And, you know, and just seemed to be going, you know, just climbing, really. I mean, she had a good supporting role in The Studio last year, and so it just feels wrong that she's gone. It honestly feels way too soon.
She's really, really good in The Studio, of course, which they're making the second series of now. Also in The Last of Us.
I was going to say,
The Last of Us as Gail, which is obviously a character just for the show.
It's not just comedy. Like, she could do drama as well.
Yeah. I mean, to me, she'll always be my Delia Dietz. That's how I think I first encountered her and how I always remembered her. And obviously she returned for Beetlejuice. And I think the last time we physically saw her on screen was boarding a train to the afterlife, which was at the end of that film.
You're right.
But it's very, very sad. Very sad indeed.
Very much so. And Home Alone is the thing that immediately came to mind. There's just some line readings in that she delivers that are seared into my memory. Kevin! All that sort of stuff.
She gave a more welly in fairness.
I can't replicate Kevin. What Kevin O'Hara did.
I'm almost so dried on the line there. He was like, line, what is it? She's on the plane and she forgets it. She remembers she left her son behind. The son's name is...
Wait,
it's like me
it.
When I did Live from London. It was...
Kevin!
Kevin?
Kevin.
Kevin?
Kevin!
It is an amazing line reading. Hers, not yours. And
that's fair.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's been well documented what I think of that movie, but it's inarguable how good she is in that film.
Yeah. Absolutely. And in most things, let's be honest.
And in most things, yeah. She was amazing. Did you have love for her in anything else, Amon?
James mentioned The Last of Us. She's comedic in that, but she's really sharp as well. And she delivers a lot of sort of hard truths to Pedro Pascal's character. And it's a new character that they brought in for the show. And she really makes it her own. Mm. Really enjoyed her introduction. I was looking forward to seeing more of her in that show. Mm.
Yeah, she was just 71. 71. She passed away after a brief illness last week. And very, very, very sad indeed. The great Catherine O'Hara. My favorite O'Hara in many, many ways.
Wow.
And
I mean, yes, but wow.
And she will be very, very sorely missed. The first images have been unveiled just too late to make it into last week's podcast of the Beatles in Sam Mendes's The Beatles, a four-part cinematic event, which somehow ludicrously still seems to be the title of this movie, or movies, we should say, when they hit cinemas in April 2028. They still haven't announced the plan for release, but Scuttlebutt has that they'll all be released at the same time.
Whoa.
The same time. I thought they might, you know, stagger them and have one a week. But then that would be giving a different weight. So if you went John first, you'd be saying, well, John's a de facto leader of the Beatles, I guess. And maybe that wouldn't quite work out.
But are these a clue? Are these pictures a clue?
Are they a clue?
I don't know.
Talk me through it, Helen.
Well, we have Paul Mescal as Paul McCartney.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, just to be clear.
Good casting.
Thanks. Yeah. But he's in the sort of like early mop top kind of look in this picture.
Yeah.
Right? And then you've got maybe slightly later Ringo, which is, of course, Barry Keoghan.
Barry Keoghan, shifty Barry. I'm tossing them.
In maybe a slightly later hairdo, like the mop top has grown out a bit.
Yep.
And then I think then in my email, it was then Joseph Quinn. And then it finished with John Lennon. Now, I don't know if that's an order thing or if that's just coincidence.
Yes. So apparently these were released. These were a set of postcards that were available last week for eagle-eyed people to spot, and then they released them. They released them officially as well. I think also because they knew that the cast would be out and about this week in costume. So there have been pap shots since of Paul Mescal as Paul McCartney, and so they wanted to get the drop on that and make sure that the first look we got of these people was actually official and well lit as well. My initial reaction to this, I think you might be right. We don't know what these movies are. I'm not so sure that it's going to be as simple as Paul's is set in the early days of the Beatles.
I don't know.
You mean release order, maybe.
Maybe release order, but maybe it is, you know, that one is a focus in each era. And, and obviously you've got to have some amount of crossover and you know, everybody's got to be in everybody else's movies by definition.
Yeah.
But maybe there is a little bit of a different focus on people at different times.
Possibly. The one issue with that for me would be that the complexity of the Beatles' relationships and the way that everything shifted, especially the John and Paul relationship, and I think that needs to be explored by giving everyone equal weight in a movie. I think if, say, for example, John was the last one at a time when things were becoming really, really fractious for the Beatles, and you saw everything from John's POV, well, I'd like to see something from Paul's POV as well. So I think that's what they're going to do.
Oh, no, I don't think it'll be purely POV. I just think there'll be maybe a little bit of... Because, for example, if you're bringing in Yoko Ono, that's obviously later on, but she's presumably going to be a big part of John's story. So so there has to be a little bit more time in his film, presumably, given to those later years. Presumably, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is pure speculation, weaving a fabric of possible lies on the strength of these films. And it might literally be that they've chosen the films where the haircuts make the most look like the relevant Beatle.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It may be that Paul Mescal looks a bit like Paul McCartney when he's got the mop top and absolutely not for the rest of the films.
Maybe.
That's possible.
Yeah.
But it just occurred to me that maybe you do start with Paul because he was so young when you began, and you know, he's really it's a real coming of age story. Maybe, you know, you want George Harrison to be the focus during the sort of breakup period because he was the one who was kind of walking out the door at one point. Maybe you want to spend more time on John Lennon's immediate post-Beatles years. I don't know. But that's purely speculation on my part.
My feeling is that it goes up to the Beatles breakup and stops. That is John, late era Beatles John, for sure.
Fair enough.
It is very interesting. Okay, I'm going to ask you guys a question, Amon and James. How important, when it comes to a biopic, is fidelity, facial fidelity? How important is it for you guys that the actor playing the character looks a little bit like the character they're playing? Are you okay with someone not resembling who they're playing, the Jeremy Allen White, Bruce Springsteen approach, for example, where he played Carmy from The Bear with a guitar? Or do you want to go full Bohemian Rhapsody, where they just stick a fake moustache on Rami Malek and go, that'll do? Because here they've got prosthetics, right? So Barry Keoghan as Ringo. So, you know, yeah. Is that important to you, for example? Amon?
It's not unimportant, but it will always be secondary to have you nailed the essence of the guy you're trying to play via performance. If the acting wasn't at the level where it can burst through the prosthetics, then the prosthetics would just be, you know, basically all surface, no actual depth.
Mm.
You need the combination of both for it to really sing.
Mm. Remember, Chris, your skepticism about Austin Butler.
You mean Elvis?
Exactly.
I know, and this is why I'm trying to take a helicopter view of this whole thing, because Jimbo, I look at these pictures of the four people playing the Beatles,
yes.
And I see Paul Mescal actually looking a lot like Paul McCartney.
Agreed.
I see Barry Keoghan looking a lot like Ringo Starr.
True.
I see Harris Dickinson from a distance, looking like John Lennon, of course, not John Legend, John Lennon. And then I see Joseph Quinn looking like apparently someone the Beatles used to hang out with, and I'm waiting for them to release a picture of George Harrison, because he looks... nothing like him. I mean, nothing like him. Even the hair color's wrong. What's going on, James?
I mean, it helps that I have literally no idea what George Harrison looks like.
You know what John Nugent looks like.
I do.
Like, right?
So, and that's George Harrison.
Yes, George Harrison.
That is genuinely my only point of reference here.
Yeah.
Does he look like the Nuge? No.
He doesn't look like the Nuge. They've got it wrong.
it's an odd thing to do when you have clearly made an effort to make three of them look demonstrably like someone. And if, as you say, I'm taking your word for it, one of them doesn't, one of these things is not like the others. That's an odd choice. But I don't think it always matters hugely. Weirdly, I had no problem with Jeremy Allen White as Springsteen. I could see it. I
as
could
Barry
see
Springsteen.
It. Yes, I could see the similarity. But I
could you?
Yeah, genuinely.
Were you squinting?
Yeah, a little bit. But I could see there was something there. I think if you can capture, as Amon said, the essence, if you can capture something about them, you know, but genuinely, so I think sometimes mannerisms, vocal tics, things like that are almost more important than is your bone structure the same?
Exactly.
Because like you'll bump on it for the first 5 minutes of the film, and then after that you won't think about it again if they capture what you think of as the person. But the other thing is, it depends on who you're playing, right? So if you're playing someone who is almost caricatured in their mannerisms, you can get to the point where it can become distracting and it look like an SNL skit. So I think those are the more difficult ones to do, because you want to capture that, because you need to capture that for verisimilitude. But if you go too far, it looks like a spoof. So actually, if you find people who are less mannered, less caricatured, I think, you know, it's a lot easier to do.
All right. Well, listen, we live in optimism, right?
Every day.
Can we go back? Because you said that the scuttlebutt says that they're going to release this all at once.
Yeah.
That would be very surprising to me. Like, we just, the other week, were talking about Wonder Man and the release schedule for that. It feels like there would be enough from sort of character to character focus that they could spread the releases of all of this out. And that would be to its benefit, because then it would dominate the conversation for weeks on end rather than just 1 week or weekend. Release everything, and then people move on.
This was a suggestion made not by us, but other people when they were first announced. So. Mm.
But then also you have the... arguably, it's less of an event that way. If something is like... And it's very Beatly. It's, you know, they were pioneers. They were breaking ground all the time. Mm-hmm. If they go four films, filmed at the same time, edited at the same time... You can see why the release date's in another 2 years, because Mendes has got his work cut out here.
Mm-hmm.
And then released at the same time? That's pretty wild. And also, if you were to release them, say, one a week through the month of April, and the reaction to the first couple wasn't that great, then the box office for, say, the Beatles Ringo really tails off. Whereas if you release them all at the same time, then people can pick and choose. And also, the cultural conversation should continue through the few weeks ahead, because people will be catching up with them, because you won't have time to see all four in one day or one weekend, most likely.
But that's an interesting question. Like, what's he going to go with for the runtime? Because if these are like a tight 75 minutes, you could pretty much do them back to back, right? You know, it's like, how long are they going to be?
Where's the achievement in that, Jimbo? I want 3-hour behemoths. That's what I want. It's going to be amazing.
The Beatles extended edition.
Oh my God. I want them as long as Peter Jackson's Get Back. And if not, longer. All right. That's enough Beatles chat. Let's see what else happened in the world of movie news. Trailers. The Devil Wears Prada 2.
Yes.
They're all back. All your favorites from The Devil Wears Prada 1. Andy, and the other three are back. Miranda. So, did Emily Blunt play a character? Unit shutting down. Did Emily Blunt play a character called Emily in the first movie?
Correct.
Yes.
But the joke was that Miranda called them all Emily. She would call Anne Hathaway also Emily because she didn't care to learn her assistant's names, you see.
Ah, I see. Yeah. All right. So what did we make of this trailer?
I think it's promising without giving very much away. There was some suggestion online that the gimmick about Miranda refusing to remember either Emily or Andy's names made her look a bit more doddery than bitchy. I don't think that's entirely fair.
I read that too. I don't read that from the trailer.
I just have fun watching Meryl Streep and Stanley Tucci back together. Yeah. I just, like, that alone would be enough for me. The fact that you've also got Emily Blunt and Anne Hathaway is just a bonus, really. And I feel like they would probably see it the same way.
Yeah.
So, I don't feel bad about saying that. But I'm intrigued by this. The idea is that Andy is back to be the features editor of Runway, but they're now up against Emily, who is, I think, married a billionaire and now has money to burn and may not be using it for them, but against them.
It looks loads of fun.
Yeah. Just vibes and gowns is basically what that trailer was, with very little plot information, but I like them.
You have me at vibes.
And gowns.
Beautiful gowns.
Many beautiful gowns.
Will they be cerulean?
This looks great. They all look wonderful. Don't they look wonderful?
They all do.
Doesn't Anne Hathaway look glowing? You can see why William Shakespeare fell in love with her. Anyway, so some very, very quick movie news to talk about. The final Fast and Furious movie has been not only given a release date, March 17th, 2028, just a couple of weeks before the Beatles, a four-part cinematic event, John. The Beatles, a four-part cinematic event, George, And the Beatles, a four-part cinematic event, Ringo. It is also entitled Fast Forever.
Surely that should be the Fast and the Furious,
It really should.
Fast Forever.
Although I respect their commitment to the bit of having absolutely no consistency in the nomenclature whatsoever, and I'm here for it.
Yeah. So this is apparently going to be the last one. They finally announced it. It was meant to be out 2 years ago, and they've been just spinning their wheels, and Louis Leterrier is back, and it's exciting. That March release date is wild, because this has become a summer franchise. Yeah. And March, I know global warming and all that, but March at the moment is not summer. So maybe it will be by 2028.
It's 17th of March though, St. Patrick's Day! Yeah, this is clearly going to be an Ireland set Fast
well,
and Furious
movie.
It
can't be, can it? Because his whole thing is like, what he said about what he wanted this to do.
This
he wanted
Vin
to
Diesel.
Go back to street racing. Yes, Big Vin, Dom yeah. Toretto. Back to street racing roots, the best of the franchise.
You said they don't have streets in Ireland. You can race in Ireland.
Yeah.
But he wants it in LA. He wants it back in LA. He wants it toned down so none of the
Limerick
over-the-top going to space stuff. Much the same thing. He wants it going back to its roots, and he wants Brian back.
Oh, come on, don't do that.
I can't see it happening.
Street racing, LA, Brian.
Yeah. He says a lot of stuff to Vin Diesel.
Do I take this to mean that you think Fast and Furious 1 is better than Fast 5?
We've already established it is the greatest of the Fast and Furious.
That's just wrong.
Yeah. Point break with cars.
I'm taking issue with the word final here, because in no way, shape, or form, there's no way that they don't, 10 years or whatever from now, bring these characters back for a legacy sequel. With Dom doing something street. This is not the final Fast and Furious movie. I'm prepared to say that right now.
He's in denial.
He's not prepared to let it go.
Yeah. He can never let go of family.
Family.
I mean,
you
say that. I kind of jumped off the Fast and Furious train a couple of films ago.
No, they're cars, I'm on.
they're sometimes also trains.
And tanks and planes and spaceships.
Well, actually, in Fast 5, they jump onto a train.
They do.
Does that help? And then I think they drive off the train.
This metaphor has gone off the rails.
That's what they did too.
Yeah, like the train.
So hopefully these final films can restore my faith in the franchise and can take it back to the best of it, but like, as I say, the last couple haven't really done it for
me. You were not enchanted by Dante?
Oh, Dante was great.
That was one of the few things that I liked about that movie.
Yeah, Jason Momoa. Bring him back.
Is he coming back? Because like, it ended on a fucking cliff. Well, not a cliffhanger as much as a dam hanger, but...
Dam buster.
Right. So are they even picking that up? Or will it just be like, 5 years later with family?
5 years later, yes. Due to contractual obligations, Jason Momoa is no longer in this film. I don't know. Who knows? And will the mooted Hobbs versus Jason Momoa's character spin-off that was meant to happen? That doesn't seem to be happening either with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And yeah, I don't know. There's so many characters. I just want to see Luke Evans' story concluded. I want to see Owen Shaw given closure.
Right. You don't think he was given closure by saving a baby from a plane that one time?
And then just going, bye, and then leaping out of the plane? Yeah.
I want to see The Rock team up with the kid from Up, and it be Fast and Furious, Russell and Hobbs. No?
What are they going to be doing?
Some kind of boiling point.
Something.
Yeah. No? I've broken Chris.
Use balloons to take the car airborne.
I mean, Kurt Russell's already in the franchise. Why did you have to bring the kid from Up into it?
I see what you're saying.
To be fair, he doesn't play a character called Russell.
No. We don't know that. He's
that's
Mr.
True.
Nobody.
Oh, that's
that
true.
Is true. He could be Russell Nobody.
Oh, my God.
Or Russell Kurt. Be an amazing name
or
for
just
him.
Fuck it, Kurt Russell. I mean.
Fuck it. Yeah, Kurt Russell.
Fuck it, Kurt Russell.
It's a bit like John Roger Legend, isn't it?
Much the same.
Anyway, okay. One last thing. Mike Flanagan's The Exorcist is moving apace, and it has added Chiwetel Ejiofor to its cast.
Mm.
Hooray!
Hooray! Do we have any more details?
No!
Okay!
Apparently he might be playing a former priest.
Oh, I love a former priest in these movies.
Because then they're tortured, aren't they?
They're tortured. And they're probably, let's be honest, literally tortured also.
Crisis of faith.
You will probably die if you're a former priest. Like, I don't wish it on him, but like I worry for him.
I don't want... No! No one
I'm
wants...
Just saying.
No!
I'm just saying.
I don't want Chiwetel Ejiofor to die, and, you know...
What tends to happen when people's faith shakes in an Exorcist movie? Oh, they die.
The lamps shake as well, and then the demon goes, "You have no jurisdiction, you're a priest." No, wait, that's Law and Order. Anyway.
Any film that Chiwetel Ejiofor is cast in just got better. He's a fantastic actor.
Yeah,
have you watched Serenity the other day? He is so good.
He's so good in Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy, where he plays a tortured former priest. You know, he's so great. So that's exciting. ScarJo, of course, in that. Noah Jupe. In that too, and Diane Lane. So when I said I didn't have any more information, I had loads of information. Yeah.
So Noah Jupe. So this was, he'll be hoping to die in this. Again, I saw Death Obsessed, but Noah Jupe has been apparently complaining to his little brother. Like when Jacoby Jupe was cast in Hamnet, he was like, "I'm going to have to die again on screen," because apparently every film he makes, he dies. Yeah. And Noah was like, "I never get to die, so maybe he'll get lucky this time."
Noah Jupe will die.
That's the dream.
That's the dream for him. I let me again be clear. I'm not wishing death on anybody. I'm just predicting death.
The Empire Podcast
better.
Does not wish death on anybody.
Well, maybe
except time for a guest.
Let's
guests.
Have it.
Shall we have guests? All right. So this week sees the return to the big screen of my beloved. Possessed Goat Boy, Sam Raimi, a.k.a. the greatest director in the history of motion pictures and the director of the finest motion picture in the history of motion pictures, Evil Dead 2. And he is back with Send Help, which strands Rachel McAdams and Dylan O'Brien on a desert island. He is an asshole boss. She is a put-upon worker who has been fucked over for a promotion, and their dynamic on that island becomes very interesting indeed. Lots of hilarious hijinks ensue. This movie is an absolute blast. And as was this interview when I went along to, a London hotel room to sit down with Rachel McAdams and Dylan O'Brien just last week. And we had a right old giggle. So here you go. Enjoy. Dylan O'Brien, Rachel McAdams, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you both?
Thanks for having us.
Doing
We're
well.
Great. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad at all. I want to dig into your Sam Raimi trauma.
Okay.
Yeah. Consider this to be like a psychotherapist couch, if you will. Obviously, they can't afford a couch, but, you know.
Should we get comfortable?
Yeah. Because day one, you guys, you told me this already. Day one on set, Sam shows up wearing a paper bag over his head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how did that make you feel?
That was it. How did that make you feel? Were you okay with that?
Slightly alarmed.
Yeah?
I have worked with Sam before, yes. So I'm on to Sam. Dylan, on the other hand.
You're on to Sam.
I remember, I feel like you walked into the office, and I was like, what is this? What's going on?
And I was like, oh, yeah, he has a paper bag on his
head. Did he do stuff like that?
He's going to do it for about 15 minutes, and then it'll be over. We'll move on, we'll talk about the script.
Yeah. It's just a phase he goes through. He needs to wear a paper bag on his head. Was it a power move? What was he doing? Was he trying to unsettle you?
Make him feel comfortable. Like,
oh really?
Like in all, yeah. Like
uncomfortable.
Comfortable.
Oh yeah, no, I'm 100%. And it's his way of feeling comfortable too, which I like really relate to. It's like a, communal ice. It's like a communal icebreaker almost. It's like very welcoming into the space, which I really appreciated because that's I think like a love language that I really associate to, or really resonates with me, and B, I don't think there was a B.
There doesn't have to be a B.
I don't know why I started doing letters.
I do that all the time. I go A, the thing.
Yeah.
And then two, like, that's not even a letter. What's going on? There doesn't have to be a B. That's the one thing we've learned about today. There doesn't have to be a B.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a B.
So, Rachel, had Sam pulled anything like that on the set of Multiverse of Madness? Or was he on his best behavior on that one?
No, the first day he came up to me and said, he got very serious and he sort of came close and said, young lady, would you like to keep your job? And I didn't know Sam yet, so he said very earnestly, yes. He said, okay, well, then you will have to do that. And faster.
Savage.
Because this isn't one of your little Canadian films, okay?
He did this bit to you straight out of the gate?
Of course. He does his... He has incredible. All the bits and they always come back for more. He's always workshopping.
He was doing this... he's workshopping. Bits. He's basically he like a closeted them, to be fair. Comedian. And he's always like workshopping like a quick 10.
He's the biggest performer of all of us. Is he a frustrated... actor as well? No, he's a great actor.
Yeah.
So he was in a film with... He's a great actor, yes.
He's very funny acting stories.
I wish he was still acting.
His story about sabotaging that other actor who got the line instead of him.
Yeah.
By like holding onto his t-shirt so that he would miss his cue. And then the AD was getting really frustrated with the guy for missing his cue because Sam was holding onto his t-shirt.
One more time, you're fired.
Oh. And then I think then Sam got the line back or something. I can't remember.
I also love that he doesn't feel bad about it.
I think he kind of does, but he knows that it's such a funny story. I don't know. Who knows?
Oh, that is amazing. And of course, Rachel, congratulations on your Hollywood Walk of Fame star.
Thank you.
Was amazing. I know Sam gave a very heartfelt speech.
Really lovely. Yes.
as well. That was a tight 10, right?
Yeah, he opened up with his rubber band bit.
Which he also kicked off the screening last night.
The premiere.
Yeah.
And when he did it at my star premiere, his girlfriend was filming and she goes, every time.
To me.
I've heard this joke.
Because I turned to her and I was like cackling because I loved it. She's like, he does it every time.
Because it works.
He has a series of rubber bands. Just for the occasion.
He walks around with rubber bands.
He brings one to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you got to that beautiful, exotic beach,
mm-hmm.
What was that like for you guys in terms of your interactions with him and your interactions with each other? Because things, you know, they go up a few notches for Linda and Bradley on that.
Cranks up a bit when we get to
it. Certainly does, yeah.
Get to the island.
A lot of calibrating and how much can we get away with.
Mm-hmm. And we had already shot so much of the film by that point. We had done the whole first half of it in Sydney. So by the time we got to that actual beach, we were kind of, we had a lot under our belts. Mm. But trying to track the jumping back and forth was a bit challenging.
Because the first half of the shoot covered so many... like pinnacle markers
big
of the
set
film.
Pieces, yeah.
And then it was like going back to the beginning on like and filling in all the beach stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really out of sequence, which is really challenging.
It was massively out of sequence, was it?
Massively. Oh, okay. Out of sequence.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, that must be,
so we couldn't get tanned. The great irony had to actually stay pale. You know, we were spending all our time on a beach. We were under these little umbrellas. Sunscreened up every morning and then tanned up every morning unless we were jumping back to...
I was burnt up every morning.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah, because Bradley is a little bit more tanned than Linda, shall we say. A little sunburnt.
He has these really bad burns the whole time.
A little ruddy.
Yeah. Never going to recover from that.
It was 12 hours in the makeup chair, wasn't it, Dylan? I think every day. Yeah. Just
the bug bites.
Yeah, call time was 1 a.m. Dedication.
And his hair grows so fast. Your hair grows so fast, which is a sign that you're a very healthy person.
It's grown about an inch since we started the interview. Which is quite a thing.
Yeah.
Quite an achievement. Is this a special skill that's on your CV? You know, the actor's special skills?
I'll advertise any. Yeah. Oh, you know that's on there.
Andy.
Shit that isn't true is on there. Yeah. I can fish.
Yep.
I can't fish.
Do you have anything, any skills that you have acquired as a result of this movie?
Nope.
What about golf? Some pretty good putting skills you got going on there.
I mean, that's just like mini golf, you know?
Just like mini golf. That was an 8 to 10 foot.
That I can handle. I can handle a little mini golf. No, I swing a golf club like a baseball bat, so I can't, I shank it. It always does this.
Okay.
I'm not much of a golfer at all.
Okay.
But you are a baseballer.
Yeah, I love baseball.
Okay.
Yeah.
A different sport, obviously, but you know.
A lot of people think, you know, because
it's the same skill set,
but it's an entirely different mechanics of the swing.
Yeah. Right.
Rachel, you into golf? You're a golfer?
You know, I used to work. I've worked at two golf courses.
Okay.
I was a waitress at two different golf courses growing up.
I didn't know that either.
And I got green, like access to the green for free.
Your swing is really good. Why again?
Thank you.
Why you were like working on it, but what was the story?
I was working on it. Yeah. I was going to the driving range. I do not play golf.
Oh, okay. You could have fooled me.
I never ever once played golf.
Really?
The whole time, all the free golf in the world, I was like, oh no, I'm okay. I'm just gonna go home now. My shift's over. We did play one time, like as a staff fun thing. We played glow in the dark golf at night.
Yes, yeah,
and that was fun.
Yeah, I like that.
But that's about the extent of it.
That's it. That's a skill you've picked up from Send Help. But that was from previous. Oh. That was before Send Help. You picked that up.
Yes,
okay. That's amazing. I've got to let you guys go in a second, but just one last thing for each of you, Dylan. This movie comes out over here, Feb 5th. This is the week of Dylan O'Brien, because Twinless also comes out
in
the UK on Feb 6th as well. You play twins in that. Imagine if Sam Raimi had directed that movie. He could have tortured you twice.
Yeah, that would have been a different version of Twinless.
That would have been a different film. If people go see the Dylan O'Brien double bill, what order should they go see them in?
Second time I've gotten this question today.
No!
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I pride myself on original questions.
I'm sorry.
Motherfucker. Who was it? I want names.
I'm scared to tell you.
We'll track them down.
Yeah.
All right.
You gave me a little red in the face, man.
Use your acting skills to pretend
you've
heard this for the first time.
I know. I should have. And instead, I can't help it. And I'm just like, dirty ass nose. I can't help it. It flies out of me. And I still don't have an answer.
Oh, yeah. I'll give you the answer.
Okay.
Start with Twinless.
Go, Rachel, go.
And then move into Send Help.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
Fun.
Why?
I would say let's go Send Help and then finish, round it off with Twinless.
Why?
Questioning me because it's the other way around.
How about you start off with Twinless, you leave Twinless halfway through.
I don't think
you go see Send Help.
No one's gonna want to see either
you
of these.
Come back, where are you going watch with the end of Twinless.
Diminishing like returns
movies?
At some point.
I love movies.
You're a movie fan.
Yeah,
and you're leaving in the middle.
Oh, movies. I thought you said golf. No, I've never seen a movie. I have no idea what movies are.
It's all an AI simulation. It's fine. It's not happening.
When we start the interview, this is going to be completely different. This is just the test. The test run.
This is rocking.
Yeah, I think it's good. A, it's been great, and only A.
Two.
There has been. There's no B.
You got to.
There's no B.
This figure.
I can't count to B.
I can't count to B.
The last thing, Rachel. I have seen movies. One of those movies is Game Night. We say this on the Empire podcast all the time, but your delivery of the line, yes, oh no, he died, we say this all the time, is the greatest line reading in the history of cinema. The history of cinema.
I can when die were, happy now.
When you were delivering that line, did you think, this is about to be the greatest line reading in the history of cinema?
I did it.
Don't mess it up.
I did it.
You did it.
I didn't think that. No, yeah. It was 4 a.m. and I was like, what am I saying?
Oh my God.
And that's where brilliance happens, I guess.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, no, that's so sweet of you, though. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. It was an amazing line reading, and that experience was preparation for this interview. So it all comes around full circle.
Incredible.
Life is beautiful, isn't
there
it?
There we go. Absolutely. Brilliant. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope they record this. Rachel Dillon, thanks so much for
today. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to see
you. Buddy.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much. Thanks, guys. Okay, that was Rachel McAdams and Dylan O'Brien talking about Send Help. And now it is time to send help to us because we have about 24 minutes to review a dozen films, starting with Jimbo, Send Help.
So really quickly then, is what you're saying. Okay, I'll do my best.
It was implied.
It was implied, and indeed it's dead. You've already covered the plot, haven't you? But it's like this is a survival horror comedy, I guess. And Rachel McAdams is this sort of meek and mild financial strategist, and Linda Liddle, and she, after a deeply upsetting tuna sandwich incident, gets passed over for a promotion by her new bellend boss, nepo baby boss, Dylan O'Brien's Bradley Preston. However, the tables are turned because the corporate jet that they're on crashes on a desert island. There are only two survivors, and wouldn't you know, it's Bradley and Linda. He naturally goes to pieces. She, a former would-be survivor contestant, flourishes, thrives in this wilderness environment, and the power dynamic kind of gets reversed. And then after a while, Bradley starts to resent his reliance on his former employee, and their relationship sours a little bit, and everything goes a bit Lord of the Flies. This is genuinely funny at times, to be fair. I had a pretty good time with it on the whole. It's quite gnarly. It's got blood, guts, gore. There's an eviscerated pig.
Lots of puke.
And lest we forget, the tuna sandwich is so upsetting. The performances are really, really fun. McAdams, who's brilliant in everything, let's be honest, but kind of she transforms from this downtrodden caterpillar to this sort of Robinson Crusoe-esque butterfly, and that's really fun. And she's also really good with the dark parts of this because she... You know, she starts off this office mouse type character and then gradually becomes ever more unhinged as the film goes along. So I really liked her. It plays cleverly, I think, with your sympathies as you go through because they're both kind of bellends in their own way, which is fun. So it's enjoyable. However, for me, I found it pretty obvious exactly where this was going quite early on. And then I was just kind of waiting out the clock a little bit. And I think so for me, it felt a little stretched, like, because it's quite a simple premise. And I think, you know, with a tighter runtime, I think it would have been spot on for me. It just outstayed its welcome a tiny little bit. It was described to me by someone as an overlong episode of Tales from the Crypt. And I was just like, I kind of see that aspect of it. It is fun. I did like it. But I ultimately it was a little bit flabby for me. It could have done with trimming a little bit, but fun.
I went into it not knowing anything about it, and I really, really loved this. It wrong-footed me. I thought this film was going to end a certain way for a good chunk of the runtime, and then things shift. And let's just say I was completely, completely wrong, but I loved the switch up that it did. Playing with your sympathies is exactly right. And it's interesting sort of thinking about how I felt at certain points of the film, knowing how it played out and what you kind of explained away at certain points in the film, only for stuff to happen, which makes you think differently about certain characters. So I thought it was great. And Sam Raimi being the horror guy that he is, a couple of moments did get me a little bit.
I really, really, really enjoyed it. I do have notes. I think there's another film which I'm not going to mention because even mentioning it would be a spoiler.
Star Wars.
Wow, no, but anyway, we're not going to mention it, that that did something similar recently, and I wish this had felt fresher if for people who have seen that. But at the same time, I just really enjoyed the madness of it. I really enjoyed the shifts in the dynamic. I do think Rachel McAdams is amazing. I love her. It's an incredible performance. But I do think she's not the perfect casting for this because... Even if she has a bit of tuna sandwich on her face, she's still Rachel McAdams, right? And I think the level of visceral disgust that the guys in the office have for her would be better explained if she wasn't Rachel McAdams. So I was willing to suspend disbelief, and it's a good enough performance that God knows she makes it very, very easy to suspend disbelief. But it isn't, I think, the perfect casting for that role, if I'm perfectly honest. Having said that, I had a great time.
I disagree with that, and we'll get into that on our supporter special.
All right.
There may even be fisticuffs.
Well, okay.
Because the supporter special will be on a deserted island, and it's going to be just me. I forgot to tell you that.
Good luck.
Oh, no, I'm not going to survive that, by the way. But, you know, go out on a high, right?
I loved the film. I do think the point would have been a bit stronger if she weren't conventionally gorgeous, that's all.
I disagree with that.
I think they do a reasonably good job of it's not quite like She's All That, where they've just put glasses and dungarees on her. Like, they do actually do, I thought, quite a good job of taking her natural radiance down a few notches at the beginning.
They have essentially put glasses and a grey cardigan
and
on
a tuna sandwich on her.
I mean, but anyway, this is, like I said, that was a nitpick. I really did have a nice time with it.
Well, I love this. I think this is the 15th joint greatest movie of all time.
Of course.
Along, obviously, with Evil Dead, Crime Wave.
We don't have time for you to list them all.
Oh, that's right. I said we don't have time. And then I wanted to list all of Sam Raimi's films. I love this. It's my boy, and he's back. And this is, you know, I struggled a little bit with Multiverse of Madness, but this is my boy firing on all cylinders. But this is not the show-off Sam Raimi. This is not the visual stylist. This is a very buttoned-down, very classically directed movie. Bill Pope's the DP as well, and they really do conjure up some fantastic images. The camera isn't moving around at 100 miles an hour until he wants it to, and then there's real moments of impact when that happens. But it's more about the battle of wills between these two, as James said, prize bellends, and about, you know, and I think it did a really, really good job of successfully flipping your sympathies for both Linda and Bradley a number of times during the movie. And I do think it is quite deliciously twisted and dark, and I'm fascinated. This spoiler special is going to be really, really great. Yeah, you're going to have to join us on the desert island as well, guys, because I'm really intrigued to see A, the ending James could see coming a mile away.
Yeah.
I'd like to interrogate that.
Okay.
B, I'd like to see hear the ending Amon was flummoxed by. And three, I'd like to hear the movie that Helen thinks is a dead giveaway. Because
okay.
I don't know what that is, apart from maybe Hamnet. I don't know what it is. But yeah, I love this. This is tremendous fun. And four stars. Four stars to my beloved, possessive goat boy, Sam Raimi. Well done. More power to his elbow, please. And please don't make it a long time before we see a Sam Raimi film again.
Mm.
Four stars and percent help. Next up, I mentioned Hamnet. Should we stick with Hamlet?
Yay.
Because confusingly, they've released Hamlet a couple of weeks after Hamnet.
Yeah.
This is Riz Ahmed, Hell's Bells.
Yeah, this is Riz Ahmed in an Anil Carrier version of Hamlet. It is a, I guess technically it's a loose adaptation of Hamlet, if we're honest, because they've chopped down the text. They've basically focused on every scene that has Hamlet himself in it. There's no two other characters talking about Hamlet.
Oh,
while
really?
He's somewhere else in this. This is like Hamlet.
So how short
as a
is this?
First, it's just about the 2 hour mark, or just under, I think.
Five stars.
but it makes it into quite a compulsive sort of first person thriller. It's basically this guy finding out at his father's funeral that something is deeply wrong and that maybe his uncle killed his dad. This is him having a confrontation with his father's ghost. And is he imagining it or is it real? This is him being driven on a, you know, roller coaster of revenge, essentially, for this great wrong that he thinks has been done. It's got a terrific supporting cast. Sheba Chadha as essentially his mum, Gertrude, is off the charts great. Art Malik is his uncle. Avijit Dutt is a fantastic elder Hamlet, the ghost, essentially. And you've got Morfydd Clark, Joe Alwyn, and Timothy Spall as their sort of...
So Joe Alwyn's in both Hamlet and Hamlet.
He is in both Hamlet and Hamlet.
Blimey.
He's Laertes here with Morfydd Clark as Ophelia. But Ophelia's role has been slightly sort of smooshed together with Horatio's, so she's also sort of a best friend confidant as well as the former love interest. So I thought that... I thought it was a cleverly done thing. And what I think is great about this is it's sort of in subjective, almost real time. It takes place over a couple of days and mostly nights. And he's kind of wandering the city trying to figure out what to do and figure out what to feel about all of this. And like other people are saying, no, it's been months. You know, your mother is now marrying your uncle. Like time has passed and he's gone, what? No, it hasn't. Like this is all... right now. It just happened yesterday. So it's kind of like it's the subjective experience of being caught up in this crisis and not able to escape it and not able to get beyond his own head. And I thought Riz Ahmed was absolutely fantastic. This has been a passion project for him for like over a decade. He worked with the with Michael Leslie on the screenplay and sort of they workshopped it for ages. And Neil Carrier came in and gave it this first person focus, but I just thought it worked really, really well. You can absolutely nitpick it, but I'm not going to because I liked it.
Good, so there you go. Good on you.
All right. Yeah. What do we give this one?
We haven't got the review up yet, so I'm going to say it's 4 stars.
So and no one can argue with me.
Ha ha ha.
Sooth, 4 stars then.
To be, not to be.
To be, not to be. Well, he does the to be or not to be speech in classic rich boy in a crisis mode.
Oh, good.
Speeding along a road in a sports car.
I should have said, of course, 2 stars or not 2 stars, but Helen's gone for it.
That is the question.
It is the question. 4 stars then for Hamlet. Amon, next up is My Father's Shadow.
Okay, so My Father's Shadow, directed by Akinola Davies Jr. This is his directorial debut. And it's set during the 1993 Nigerian election crisis. It takes place over the course of a single day. And it stars real-life brothers Godwin and Chibuge as Akin and Remy. Mm-hmm. They spend the day with their father, played by Chope Dorizu, who is attempting to reclaim 6 months' worth of back pay. And so they're following him around as he's trying to do all of this. I really, really love this. As somebody who is a Nigerian, just to see Nigerian culture on screen.
It was filmed in Lagos, wasn't it?
It was filmed in Lagos. It feels very vibrant and just the tasty restaurants, the stylish African garb, the rich sense of community. You can all feel that coming through the screen. I love how it unpacks Black masculinity. One of the big themes in the film, just on the father's side, is yes, he's trying to earn money so that he can provide for his family, but in doing so, he's become an absentee father. And that has had an impact on his kids. So his kids revere him, but they also fear him. And there's some anger there that the film slowly unpacks, which I think is really, really good. This is a really, really, really strong directorial debut. Again, it takes place over the course of a single day, which adds some tension. As he tries to sort of get that money to help his family. So that is really well executed as well. I thought this was really great. It's had a really fantastic festival run. I think Akinola is nominated for a BAFTA. It's really resonated with a lot of people, which is beautiful to see.
Yeah, I think it's really, really splendid. And watching it, I was really struck by it. I don't know how the fuck they did this. I know they went and they shot in Lagos, but it's a period piece.
Yeah.
I presume they just threw Chope and these two incredible kid actors. I don't know if anyone saw the Embeth Davids movie, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, which only got a release here straight to streaming, essentially, about a month and a half ago. But there's an amazing kid performance in that, the central kid performance, like the 7-year-old girl who wasn't really an actor. And these two kids reminded me of that. They're so real. And I can only imagine that Akinola would just drop these actors into the hurly-burly sometimes of what feels like a real Lagos market and just went, okay, I'm going to hide the cameras and you're going to go around and interact with people. And obviously there's going to be some scenes and some actors, but that feels to me like what he did. I don't know exactly if that's what he did, but it feels to me like that. There's such real veracity to what's going on. And there's an emotional kick also at the end.
There's a scene which takes place at the sea. It's very Moonlight-esque, actually, which is really powerful and beautiful. And Shoppe Dorizu, I've been a fan of his for a long time. This, I think, is career best work from him. Very vulnerable, unpacking the layers of this character. And yeah, hope this sort of propels him onto bigger and better things as well.
Indeed. 4 stars then. We gave this one 4 stars in for My Father's Shadow. Let's stick with you, Amon, for The Chronology of Water, which is Kristen Stewart's directorial debut, named by an art house movie generator. Clearly, what is The Chronology of Water?
So this is actually based on a memoir of the same title by Lydia Yuknovich, who is the character that Imogen Poots plays. And yeah, she had a difficult life, shall we say. The film opens on a stillbirth, and then the film proceeds, like the memoir, to zip through her life in non-chronological, non-linear order. So it goes through her childhood, her adolescence, motherhood, and also the discovery that she's a good writer, which is what led to the memoir, which is what led to this film. Kristen Stewart, this is her directorial debut. She's made some shorts before, but this is her feature directorial debut. Sometimes when you do that, like actor becoming the director, they could go for something which is a little bit safer than what Kristen Stewart has done here. It's very bold. She has jumped into the deep end. And you know what? She's swimming. She has the source. There's a lot of bold direction to this that brings the authorial voice of the memoir to life. And what I mean by that, one of the passages in the memoir, Lydia writes, "I remember things in retinal flashes." So like I said, it's all non-linear. So at times we get quick cuts to various moments in Lydia's life. There's dialogue overlapping with each other. The editor, whose name is Olivia Neergaard-Holm, does incredible work piecing all these various things together. So just on a sense of bold direction, I think it's incredible. Imogen Poots, she's long been a fantastic actor, but this, she is fearless, go for broke, very extreme performance, but she absolutely nails it. Honestly, it's worth going in for just her performance alone. She is utterly incredible.
Are you saying worth the price of admission alone?
I'm saying worth the price of admission
alone.
I'd
love to buzz you for that. Yeah, she's great. And she wasn't in the Oscar conversation, which is maybe a bit daft. I don't know.
She is fantastic in this. So the zipping through various elements of her life, I vibed with it, especially the second time around, but I suspect that for some people, because of the messiness of that, it's sort of hard to zero in on an arc for Lydia. But again, second time around, I found that wasn't an issue for me. I just vibed with what it was. I liked what it was putting down. So yeah, Kristen Stewart, she has the source. I hope that she goes on to collect.
That is a chronology of water, of course. It goes from water into salt. That's how water works. All right. We also gave this one 4 stars. I think, spoiler alert, everything's got 4 stars this week, except for our next movie, 100 Nights of Hero.
Yeah, this is an odd little fairy tale beast, really. So this is written and directed by Julia Jackman, and it stars Micah Munro as a very chaste, pure, law-abiding young woman called Cherry, who is married, has a lady-in-waiting hero, who is Emma Corrin. And her husband's friend, Manfred, played by Nicholas Galitzin, comes to stay in their house, and he basically makes a bet with the husband that he can seduce Cherry. And if he wins, he gets to keep their castle, their home. And she will, of course, be killed. And she is not, because it's a very misogynistic world that they live in, and it's basically ruled over by a misogynistic god called Birdman, not that one, who is played by Richard E. Grant. It's a whole mythologically complicated film, this. Anyway, so she basically has to resist the advances of He-Man himself for the titular 100 Nights. And to do this, a hero makes up lots of stories to try and distract him from his pursuit of her mistress. And so it's a kind of Scheherazade 1001 Nights kind of a setup, basically, because she tells a story about these three sisters in order to distract them from his quest. One of them is played by Charlie XCX. Anyway, so look, It's weird and wonderful, and you kind of have to get on its wavelength and go with it. It's a very feminist fairy tale, from literally soup to nuts. This is like a feminist reimagining of a 1001 Nights kind of a thing. Maybe it's because none of that seemed unusual to me that I was a bit like, well, I feel like I've seen this before. So, but it does have some cool little, you know, just twists of design. It's got a real point of view. It's got a real voice. It's got great people in it, you know, good performances. It's all just quite mannered and quite arch, and you have to sort of get on its wavelength. So I liked it, but I do think 3 stars is right. I don't think it's a 4.
Mm, agreed.
All right, 3 stars then for 100 Nights of Hero. And Jimbo, we started with you talking about Dylan O'Brien. We might as well finish with you talking about Dylan O'Brien and Twinless.
Can't get away from him this week. No, but this is a slightly twisted black comedy. This is written, directed, and co-starring James Sweeney, who did Straight Up back in, I want to say, 2019. And this sees Sweeney as Dennis and Dylan O'Brien as Roman, and they are two men who meet in a kind of support group for bereaved twins, and they strike up a bond, an instant friendship, and their relationship grows. They become ever so slightly codependent, but it becomes apparent that both men have secrets, which eventually all come tumbling out, and it makes things very, very awkward. Now, on one hand, it's kind of a sweet look at mourning, right? So O'Brien's Roman is dealing with his grief over his brother Rocky, who's died, and his guilt over the state of their relationship when he died. But also you've got Dennis, who has obviously suffered a loss, and he has somewhat odd behavior. So it's not the kind of, like, on the face of it, you think this is like a sort of friendship triumphing over grief kind of story, but it really isn't that, because it is supremely awkward at times. And Sweeney's Dennis is not just odd, he is deliberately played to be supremely unlikable, and he really kind of leans into that, but he's unlikable to everyone except Roman, which is kind of a bold move. It takes some, I think it's fair to say, interesting turns. So you will want to go into this cold, which I think is made slightly more difficult by the fact that it came out in the US, I want to say, like about 3 or 4 months ago. So do avoid reading stuff about it on the internet. Really nicely written. There's a couple of really nice split screen sequences, in particular one at a party where they both go their separate ways. I really loved that. I thought that was really well put together. So that's, but I think, honestly, the two performances were what stuck with me, because Dennis is like, he's spiky, and as I say, he's quite unlikable. And I think it's really interesting how they play with you as an audience, how you feel about him when you start to understand that character slightly better. But O'Brien, I thought, was fantastic in this, because he's this seething cauldron of like rage and resentment and guilt and neediness and vast insecurity about, you know, over his own self-worth.
He's really good.
He is really, really good in this. I really enjoyed that. It's kind of great, you know. Also, he speaks Simlish, you know, which is unusual in a film. So quite enjoyed that. Probably a first in cinema. I don't know, but it might have been. So it's a kind of a weird, dark little film. It's blackly amusing, if not laugh out loud funny, but I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah.
We gave it 4 stars.
Yeah.
I think Aisling Fantozzi as Marcy is really, really great. Mm. There's a high-pitched voice and bubbly energy that she initially has. Although she's always funny, there's one scene early on where Dennis is asking her if he should go somewhere. And she vocally says yes, but everything about her body language is saying no. And that did amuse me a little bit. But slowly but surely, she sort of becomes a more three-dimensional character with her own agency, almost in the background. I love how they did that.
Yeah, she's great.
So, props to her as well.
Mm. I think Dylan O'Brien Week, the inaugural Dylan O'Brien Week, has gone really well.
It's gone
very well.
I
look forward to it next year.
Yeah. Maze Runner, Triple Bill, anyone?
Let's not go crazy.
All right. So there we go. 4 stars in for Twinless. And on that, what was that noise?
What was that?
Not me.
Is it Dylan O'Brien in this room?
It could be.
Oh my God. So on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by Emerald Fennell, writer-director of the very faithful, I hear, adaptation of Wuthering Heights. But until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it's goodbye for my 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Amon Warman.
Peace.
Peace be unto you, my friend. You see, there's a whole make love not worth thing again. You see? It's all coming back. It's goodbye to Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye to James Roger Legend.
I am legend.
You're not an ordinary person.
Yeah, that nickname's not going to work.
I'm sticking with it.
It's gone.
Subscribe
it's
to gone. The Pilot TV podcast.
No, that you've doubled down. No, that's absolutely it. It's not going to happen anymore. Anyway, it's goodbye from me. I'm off to join my castmates on SNL Live. I cannot wait for that show to take off. This could be my ticket out of here. See you later, guys. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.